So, get going then. The first topic is what is truth? And of course, that's already we can remember, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, a question that famously is asked by quite an important person in the Gospels. And we start with Scripture and the teaching of the Church here. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, John 14:6. And here then we have a quotation next from a very famous teaching, a teaching of the official magisterium, the official teaching of the Church on faith and reason. This encyclical Fides et Ratio of 1998. It's a great, in the seminary where we start studying, I start teaching the philosophy, we start with looking at Fides et Ratio, themes from Fides et Ratio, because it's the most comprehensive teaching to date, the official teaching of the Church, on the relationship between faith and reason, philosophy and Catholic faith and theology and life. So here's a quotation here from St. John Paul II, teaching in the Magisterium there in Fides et Ratio on truth. Whenever men and women discover a call to the absolute and transcendent, the dimension of reality opens up before them. In truth, in beauty, in moral values, in other persons, in being itself, in God. So truth, already we can notice that the topic of truth is bound up together with the topic of goodness, the topic of the moral, and the topic of beauty, which Caroline will explore with you further. That relationship, as we call it, between truth and moral goodness and the truly beautiful. Sin is ugly, that's what we're saying. And that insight, the interpenetration, the deep connection between truth, beauty, being, reality, and the moral, truth, beauty, the moral, and being, reality itself, that was already seen in ancient Greece in the great philosophers like Plato and Aristotle. That interpenetration between truth, being, reality, beauty, and the morally, the truly moral, morally good. And it's something that is taken up into a higher vision in Christianity with the coming of the incarnation. But there we are, we have that flagged up already for us by in St. John Paul II, Fides et Ratio. Then a quotation here from Pope Francis in the Apostolic, there's another teaching of the Magisterium. It's on Catholic studies actually, this 2018. And the very title of this papal document is Veritatis Gaudium, which is Latin for the joy of truth. The joy of coming to know what is true. That's also something to think about. The joy that we come to when we have come to know the truth. Truth is something we're all called to as human beings profoundly in our human nature. So the whole of us is involved, and we'll think about that a bit more too. The whole of our nature is involved in coming to know the truth. We're joyful when we discover the truth. You know, a scientist is thrilled, is full of joy when he or she comes across some answer to a question. Somebody, you know, an explorer out in the Amazon, oh yes, this little butterfly, I thought it was here, I thought this species was here, and I found it. You know, this joy, and in that sense, two human beings, the joy of finding what is true about being, about reality, is something that in a distant sense we reflect the Creator himself, because God creates and he is pleased, he is full of joy in himself, and he rejoices in his creation, in the beauty and truth of his creation. So that's something about truth too. Truth is something we're called to. It's of our own nature, our essence, to find truth and to live according with truth. And so everything else is involved in that too. Our feelings, our emotions, and so forth. So the joy of truth expresses the restlessness of the human heart until it encounters and dwells within God's light and shares that light with all people. For truth is not an abstract idea, but is Jesus himself, the Word of God, in whom is the life that is the light of man. Here, Pope Francis is echoing, you feel, great line of St. Augustine, great Christian writer, great saint Christian writer of the 300s and early 400s. You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and we are restless till we rest in you. You made us for yourself, and we are restless till we rest in you. That's a great line in St. Augustine, and there that's being echoed by Pope Francis, this truth of God. We are restless till we find that, and then we can rest in that truth, contemplate it, and find joy in it, the true fulfillment of our human nature. And then this point here, that truth is not an abstract idea, but is Jesus himself. This point is already emphasized in the encyclical we just mentioned, that Pope Francis is saying is we find it also in Fides et Ratio, before him, in John Paul II's Fides et Ratio, where he writes, in Jesus Christ, who is the truth, faith recognizes the ultimate appeal to humanity, an appeal made in order that we experience as desire, that what we experience as desire and nostalgia may come to its fulfillment. And further, this truth which God reveals to us in Jesus Christ is not opposed to the truths which philosophy perceives, human reason perceives. On the contrary, the two modes of knowledge lead to truth in all its fullness. Sometimes when we talk about, of course, when we talk about Jesus is the truth, it's the person of Jesus is the truth. It's because Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. He is God. And God is the source of all truth. God is truth in that sense. And God is the source of all created things. And so the truth of our knowing those created things comes from God. God makes us what we are, these truth seekers and truth finders. So God is the source of all truth. And of course, the opposite, as we know from the Gospels, Satan is the father of lies. Lie is against the truth. Satan is the father of lies. But just this last point, sometimes people, it's an interesting point really perhaps to think about a little bit, sometimes when we talk about this in this way, that it's Christ that we see, what our faith is about, rightly, we say, is about the encounter, the loving encounter with the person of Christ. And sometimes that can get people a bit confused, and they can sort of think, oh yes, you know, faith is about the encounter with a person, the loving encounter with a person. So it's not about all these kind of, you know, Catholic dogmas, you know, these sentences, these propositions, and such, like the creed is a list of sentences and different things and so forth. And people can sometimes say, well, you know, our faith is about my encounter with Jesus. It's not about a list of things, you know, a list of sentences like that. Oh yes, I agree to this, I agree to that, I agree to that, I agree to that. Like the creed and all the dogmas of the church, you know, you look in the catechism and other books that, if you know, study theology, there's all these dogmas and there's all this, you must believe in this, you must believe in that, you must believe in that. You know, it's not about all that. It's about my encounter with Jesus. Well, that's rather confused. And the way I start to explain why it's confused is just with a little story to start off with. This is what, you know, philosophers and theologians talk about propositional truth. You know, a proposition is the cat sat out on the mat. It was difficult to get out the door this morning for me, because I'm silly. Propositions are, you know, truths like that. So we list a set of truths in the creed. There's no opposition. There's no opposition at all. On the contrary, between my loving encounter and relationship with another person and with truth, that there can't be. And you can start thinking about this. Example I use imagine a young girl comes home from, works in London or something, comes back to see her mum, who's in the town outside London, and she says, Mum, I've fallen in love with this fellow and I'm engaged. And mum says, what? Goodness me, I've never heard about this before, you know, or, you know, sit down, at least tell me about it. So the girl has to start telling her mum things about the person she's in love with. And she has to start, maybe it's even quite tricky for her because she hasn't sort of formulated it before, but she said, well, you know, he's so generous and he's very considerate and he's very good looking and he's kind and he's thoughtful. And in a sense, that the girl is drawing up her creed. She's drawing up a creed. She's putting into propositions, into sentences, the truths about this man whom she loves. Now, hopefully she's right in her belief. But that's what all the creeds and the dogmas are, really. They're truths about the one we love, the ones we love, about the truths about God, truths about what the beloved has done for me. This is why I love him so much, because he sacrificed himself on the cross for me. All these truths, all these sentences, these dogmas of the Catholic Church that she draws up are, in a way, like that girl professing her faith in this person she loves. And of course, human relationships have to be based on truth. And if love and truth go together, and sadly, we see when things fail, it's a matter of, failure in truth. I mean, you think this about such and such a person, but really and truly, that's not the case. You know, they come across very well in the group, they come across very well on TV, but really and truly, they're not like that. So our relationship between other people is all about truth. It is all about truth, and love and truth are bound up together. So we don't, people don't want, people aren't happy if they find out the person who they thought they loved is not that person really and truly, is not like the person they really truly thought they were. They're deceitful, or they're playing false or something like that. So truth and love are bound up together, and they're bound up in our relationships with others. These things aren't opposed at all, and without people get confused about these kind of things. Pilate's question. So as I said at the beginning, what is truth? There's a famous person in the Gospels who asks that question. You are a king then, said Pilate. Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Retorted Pilate. With this he went out again to the Jews, gathered there, and said, I find no basis for a charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews? They shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Thinking about this passage, we can reflect on this passage of Scripture. We're thinking about what is truth. And again, it shows us, I think, this is a true story. It's a story of our historically happened. It's a story of our redemption. And it's also a fascinating piece of literature. You know, when you look at literature, you can get insights into different characters, and it makes you think about the dynamics of a story, the drama, what's going on, and the people involved. And, Pilate is a very intriguing character. And when we read about Pilate, and the Roman historians and the scholars can tell us quite a bit about Pilate, because there's quite a bit of information about him. But we can sort of sympathise with Pilate. There's something that's he doesn't seem like a brute. He seems like a canny politician. Not a totally unsympathetic character, a man who's got all this administration, he wants to do well in his job, he wants the emperor's approval, he wants to get on. Here are these Jewish people always arguing, fighting about this and that. His concern is about to stop riots and violence and things and so forth, and these career moves to go up. So it's a typical image of much of human life. For goodness sake, I've had to order the execution of a lot of these revolutionaries. I mean, that's just my job. Here's another one. It's almost when he pauses and goes after the people again, you can't help but think he's seen something in Jesus. You know, talking about the encounter with truth, he's seen something that's very attractive. Just in this passing encounter with him, there's something extremely attractive about this man. I don't want to kill him. I don't believe all the things they're saying. He goes out to them and said, you know, he's innocent. You know, oh, well, here's the problems again. They're going to get me in trouble with the emperor. All right, you know, I'll wash my hands of it. You know, I have to, you know, I'm doing this all the time, having these fellows sent off to execution. It's part of my job, keeping the country in order. So here's just another one. But maybe he's not quite like the rest. But anyway, never mind about that. I've got to do my pragmatic thing. I've got my job, I've got my career. You know, remember in another Gospel of Matthew, I think it is, his wife says, so the dream, don't have anything to do with that man. There's something about this person in this encounter. There's some truth seen there. There's something really good. And there's a belief, really, this man's innocent. There's nothing to doubt. Look, I'll just give him a good flogging, which would have been absolutely horrendous. It wasn't just a lie. We can see from contemporary accounts, and if you know about the Shroud, you know, a good flogging would have been absolutely appalling enough. But, you know, I'll do that and then release him. But no, they want more, and so I'll just cave in, I'll give in to him. So this again, this is a, in a way, this looks at shows us the cynical resignation of all times and places. The quest for truth and the living out of truth for all of us through history in our place, it's an existential drama. And to really pursue truth and to live by truth in our fallen state, we need the grace of Christ. We see that in our world, in our own lives. We need God's power to help us live up to our calling to find truth, and then when we've found it, live accordingly. Because as individuals and as a society, we're all marked by original sin and by all the consequent effects of original sin that accumulate over the centuries in our cultures and societies. So the fleeing from truth in my own life and so forth. And this is why, you know, individually, the sacrament of confession is so important. Sometimes people say, oh, I keep going to confession, saying the same things. But, you know, there are things to say, there are more things we can say about that. But one of the basic things we can say about confession is that it helps us keep calling sin, sin. Because we all have a tendency to rationalise that, well, no, that's not really a sin. I mean, everybody does that. And, you know, we can see in individual lives and in the life of society how everybody does that. You know, it keeps on being reported and repeated, and gradually you shift further and further and further away from the light, you know, because you excuse yourself and you excuse others and you say, and if you've done that on that, then you do that. And very often when we look at terrible cases of, you know, individuals in history, you study historical biographies of people like Hitler and that, people don't wake up and become complete devils overnight. They gradually shift, I mean, a wonderful, you know, something you can look at again and again, I think, for spiritual benefit, is the film Man of All Seasons. It's a wonderful play, Robert Bolt's play, the wonderful film Man of All Seasons there. And that whole existential drama about truth, living up to the truth, you see that in the Man of All Seasons and the different characters. There's Thomas More, who is going to live for the truth of what's just and right, and for Christ, the love of Christ, until death. But so many people around him will say, well, you know, I've got to compromise. I've got to, well, you know, I mean, that's all very well, but I've got a life to lead, I've got things to do. And that drama of truth is beautifully seen there. So our searching for truth, our living by truth, is not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. And in our fallen nature, we need the grace of Christ to help us to do that. Our own times have their place within a longer history of sin and redemption, and this flight from truth, all this. One of the big themes when I talk about it to students of this encyclical of Pope John Paul II, Fides et Ratio, a big theme in that whole encyclical I tend to call the paradox of the two calls. It's sort of a paradox, you might say. Because St. John Paul II in that encyclical says, by our human nature, we are called to be authentic human beings, and authentic human beings means to go beyond myself to the objective truth, to go beyond myself to reality, to what is true, and conform myself to the truth, not try and narrow everything down to my own sinful heart. So we're called to be authentic human beings, to find the truth and live by it. And yet, because of our, that's just our human nature. We're all called, all human beings of all cultures and places, are called by their nature to find the truth and live accordingly with it. But the paradox here is that by our own, we can't pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps because of original sin, because of the fall. We can't seem to do that. We keep running from the truth. We keep making excuses, and individuals and a society. And then, of course, we're born into societies which have had set, many areas of, you know, running from the truth. You know, you see spiritual writers and exorcists and people like that talk about, you know, the effects that previous generations spiritually have on, you know, the individuals, you know, the sins or really serious things, that bad things that parents and grandparents have been into can affect, you know, stack the dice for the young person who's born and growing up. So we grow out of this, we can grow out of traditions that more or less have been involved in running from the truth, or those, thank God, you know, if we're brought up in good families, we're in traditions that they're not free from original sin, but they're not as bad as, they're far better than they might have been. And we see other people who are very unfortunate, who we say are more sinned against than sinning. It doesn't let any of us off the hook, but you know, it's the families, the traditions we're born into. Some of them have traditions of, stronger traditions than others of trying to live to the truth and be open to the truth. But you know, without grace then, we can't really be the human beings that we're meant to be. Grace helps us just be what God intended us to be before original sin, before all the tragedy of sin. St. Paul in Romans highlights for us, 1 and 2 Romans highlights for us, and talking about society and a communal thing, and communal, as we're going on to talk about the communal search for truth and the need for communities and societies to live in accordance with truth, or the tendency of society to bury the truth, flee from it, is something St. Paul sees immediately, straight on. He's talking about, he's writing there in the beginning of the letter to the Romans, and the context there is he's writing to his Jewish brethren, and says, one of the great themes of St. Paul is that the law, yes, if the law is wonderful, the law is given us by God, but we don't have the power within us to live according with them, in accordance with the law. So the law kind of convicts us. The law is sort of like, oh, I wish I didn't know that sort of thing, because now I know how wrong I'm being. But it's a gift from God, and this is this kind of paradox that St. Paul's talking about. The law is there, given from God for the Jewish people, but the law itself doesn't have the energy, the force, to live the law. That energy is only given by the divine grace from Christ, God's love poured into our hearts with the Holy Spirit as a result of Christ's life, death, resurrection poured into our hearts. So he talks to his Jewish brethren and says, you know, you've fallen short of the law. You need Christ because you've fallen into sin. You can't get yourself out by yourselves. But he says, you almost think, well, almost like the pagans are kind of laughing behind their hand. Oh, the Jews thought they were much better off, but you see, they had the law. So that's a Paul turns around and says, look, you're not better. Don't think you're better than my Jewish brethren because you didn't have the law, because you have the law of God in your hearts. And this is something that actually St. John Paul II draws out about faith and philosophy, that, you know, the pagans, pagan philosophy and so forth, and the early fathers of the church write about this, like St. Justin Martyr, that yes, there's the seeds of the Holy Spirit even among the pagans. They have the light to see, you know, when their philosophies are good. Of course, the influence of Satan and so forth is strong in these societies, and the bad things are strong. But there are good points, there are lights of the Holy Spirit, there are seeds of the Holy Spirit in all pagan societies that lay the ground for the coming of Christ. And so human beings, just by their human nature, even after original sin, do still have the power to reason and think about the true God and the true nature of what's right and wrong, because this is God and so forth. And you see that among some, not all, but many of the important Greek philosophers, that they do take us quite a long way along the road of truth, and they see the true, something about the true nature of God, not the whole picture, and because of that true nature of God, then they can tell us something true about human beings, and they can tell us truly about certain things that are right and wrong, like we have in the, and yet, human beings being what they are, original sin, the pagans can know this, and yet they run from it. And here in this passage, we see this interconnection with this mystery of this. If we run from truth because of our passions and our desires not to do what's right, the interconnection between not wanting to do what's right, or rather sin, therefore the rejection of God, therefore the rejection of the truth. And these things are intertwined. So let's just, I'll just read it quickly, it's a long passage. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so the people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, the men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. Furthermore, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they do what ought not to be done. This is a profound image of what the truth about what happens in human societies, and the interconnection with the flight from God, the flight from truth, into sin, into the falling apart of the natural order of human relationships and what our sexuality is really for, and all this sort of stuff, the thing starts to unravel, it's all interconnected. And all this is part of this flight from truth that St. Paul is witnessing to. These themes very much, if you read the first two chapters of Romans, this is what's going on. That the pagans, having this ability, which you can see in some of the greater philosophers like Aristotle and Plato and other, and some of the philosophers before Christianity, they see certain these things, but it's there's this tendency to run away from the truth into things because of their human passions and human sinfulness, so to hide from the light. And because, well, you know, I don't want the true image of God, because that's the kind of, we see this, I think, in a lot of sort of New Agey things, or a lot of quasi, you know, I'll have a bit of Eastern religions and stuff like that you see around there. But because really those things are no threat to me. There's sort of like, in Christianity, there's somebody, there's a person, God is personal, and God loves me so much that he doesn't want me to do that. He says, no, I want you to be truly happy. Yeah, a lot of this kind of, you know, a potpourri of Eastern religions and so forth. And, well, I can sit and meditate like this and I can eat this kind of food, but there's no kind of somebody up there saying, look, just don't do that. I don't want those kind of irritating parents type looking over my shoulder. Of course, the irritating parent type of thing is a caricature of God to some extent. I mean, irritating parents, and I'm one of them, is, you know, they do it, I believe my wife does it, because we love you. Now, of course, the way you have to do things with children, as those who parents know, you know, you don't want to overdo it, you've got to do it the right way and so forth, but the bottom line is you do often have to say no to your children out of love, and that is genuinely out of love. And that's the person of God. Our God is our Father. So he says no out of love because he wants us to be truly happy. He says no because he wants us to go away, which is a bliss and ultimate happiness. But you know, a lot of this kind of sort of, you know, this thing of, oh, I want spirituality but not religion and all that kind of thing, is because, well, I can do whatever I like with that kind of, you know, I can have a little statue of the Buddha and I can put something here and you know, but I can suit myself really. I'm not challenged by this passionate love of God. I can just get on, do my own thing. So I'll just talk a little bit towards the end about a little bit more of sort of the philosophy of truth and knowing truth and coming to know the truth. I think this is kind of a useful model here. I think it's just a model, I think it's true. This is just a model. It's not a model. Scientists use models because they think they might be true. Anyway, I won't get on to that. This is, I think, is true. It's and in fact we can check it out whether it's true or not. A kind of a teasing out of the process of coming to know the truth. I think that's in the thought of St. Thomas. This depends, this comes out of, I believe, Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, with the help of modern philosophers teasing this out, developing it further, like St. John Henry Newman and the 20th century Jesuit philosopher Bernard Lonergan, but drawing that this fundamentally out of Aristotle and St. Thomas's thought. And St. Thomas tells us that truth is known in judgment. And so for human beings, unlike angels, we believe in angels, that is a dogma of the Catholic faith, they exist. Unlike angels, as theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas will teach, angels know truth immediately in their creation. By they know reality, they know things, they don't know absolutely everything, not like the future, history and so forth, and like God. But they know the nature of things, they know the whole world, they know all about quarks and quantum mechanics and bunny rabbits and everything just at the moment of their creation as an angel. And angels know these things depending on how higher or lower they are. So, you know, when you're dealing with Satan, the fallen angels, you're dealing with incredibly intelligent beings. That's why the exorcists tell us you have to be very careful and follow the right instructions. You don't get into long debates with them and they mess you up. So, but for us human beings, we don't know like that. We have the history of science, don't we? Why do we have the history of science? Because we don't just see everything, understand and know everything the first moment Adam and Eve were created. Knowing is a long, long process for us to come to know to know things. Well, to know more, obviously, the little things around us we start with, we know them very quickly as small children. But the natures of things and so forth, it takes us a long time. St. Thomas Aquinas famously says in one place he talks about a bee, and in another place he talks about a fly. And he says, what is the actual nature of a fly? What's the essence of a fly? I know a fly has an essence, and it exists, this fly, or this bee. But he says, well, I knew a man, who's probably another Dominican, who spent 30 years studying bees, but he still said, I don't really understand their essence, he said. Of course, that's what happens in science, that science builds upon our common sense knowledge of bees and flies, and then the accumulated wisdom of like beekeepers who know all sorts of things about bees more than I do, but then science takes that and has to go further and further And of course the areas of science all interlock, don't they? And if you just go on Wikipedia, source of all wisdom and knowledge, and look up a fly or a bee, it'll tell you sort of like general knowledge, and then it'll tell you a little bit about, or you know, the science of them. And if you look at that, well, when you understanding the science of a bee, that interconnects with the whole history of chemistry, the whole history of nutrition. Why does it take this? Why does certain bees eat that? Because of the physiology of the bee, and it can ingest that. And so the whole area of physics and chemistry all comes into the study of a single bee. And chemistry and physics and zoology takes centuries of development and experiment to arrive at that. You know, well, I can just read in a Wikipedia article today. That's taken centuries. What I'm on about here is that truth is a process, and we can identify in our own selves a kind of three-level process of coming to know. There's lots more we can say about this. It's a whole course, you can do a whole course on this, but I'm just trying to talk a little bit about this now. So this is the structure of coming to know, the process of coming to know truth, reality, being, what is, as Caroline was talking about, you know, being, reality, what is, that's what we come to know. And we start as human beings with this first level of experience. We see, hear, smell, taste, touch, we have sort of inner feelings of balance and so forth. But then as human beings, what's profoundly wonderful about us, and you can see it from small children, we ask questions. What is it question? We ask, well, what's that noise outside? What's going on? Or what's that image I can see through the window? What is it? We have wonder. Aristotle says wonder is the beginning of philosophy. So we ask questions and we say, well, what is it? What's going on? Or what does he mean by what he said? Or why has he got that expression on his face today? What is it? And then we move up to this second, if you like, phase or level of where we have insights into the data, insights into what we smell, feel, touch and taste. We form concepts, ideas, theories, hypotheses. We come up with explanations. Well, I think he's looking like that today because, he's had a bit of bad news, you know. And somebody says to me, well, no, I don't think so. I think he hasn't heard about that yet. I know, because he says, you know, so we can have different, we come up with our ideas, our insights. But then we're not just satisfied as human beings with lovely ideas. We want to know, does my idea correspond with reality? Does it fit with reality? Does it tell me about what is truly so? So we naturally ask the further question, is it true? St. Thomas talks about a quid sit question, sounds like money, quid sit and ansit. Is my idea, my hunch, my hypothesis, my theory really true of reality? And there we move to the level of judgment. We have to gather evidence, weigh the evidence. We judge yes or no, or probably yes, probably no. Perhaps we haven't got enough evidence at all. We say, well, I can't really make a decision about that. I can't really decide, make a judgment on that. I'd have to find out more. That could be the sensible thing. And then we can reach a judgment. It might be a certain judgment, I'm certain, or it might be a probable judgment, yes or no. And here I've compared it to the courtroom. So a judgment is like a verdict. We try and come to know what is really and truly so about reality. Whether this person did commit the crime, whether this person did steal all the money, whether this person, you know, if you have somebody is on a jury, or you're not going to do very well on a jury if you have some people say, well, I can't really know the truth, you know. Well, great, thanks. Well, this guy's going to go to prison for life. It depends on finding the truth, whether this man is sent to prison for life or is acquitted. You have to, if you have a sort of, somebody who's heavily into postmodernism subjective as well, we can't really know the truth anyway, so you might as well just send him to prison and, or let him go free, you know, I don't know. No, we all as human beings know, again, morally, we ought to try and attend to the data as much as we can, be careful, look at the exhibits they bring into court. We try to be, we have different gifts from God about how intelligent we are, but, you know, here, man's life depends on it, whether he spends life in prison or not. I've got to really try and think this through. Well, does that evidence of the gun, does that mean that, you know, he was there on the day and there were his fingerprints on that gun, how did they get there? Then we've got to reach a decision, a judgment. Is it true that he committed the crime or not? Let's weigh the evidence, let's hear all the evidence. So, you know, I'm just comparing this judgment, this, to a verdict in court. And you might say that sometimes we experience this in ourselves, that we're, in myself, I'm both the prosecution and the defence. I'm lying in bed, I'm thinking, well, maybe this, but no, maybe that. And then I'm like the defending lawyer and the prosecuting lawyer, and I'm trying to think something through. Or I just another example to illustrate these three levels of coming to know. I can imagine two friends, I talk about this, two friends going somewhere on a, or two business partners going somewhere on a cold, misty autumn morning. They have to change trains, they get off the train at some station, it's all misty and chilly. They're waiting on that platform, and over the wall down in the town, in the mist, there's some sort of noise and bang, and they wonder what it is. So they're both having the same experience, the cold mist on their face in the morning, the sights, the smells, this noise down in the distance down the road from the station. And then they both ask the question, that they're curious, what is it? What happened down there? What's happened? And then they might come up with different ideas or hypotheses. The one chap says, I think I've been to the station for a walk down there, I think there's a pub. I think all it is, they're just unloading beer barrels into the cellar there. I think that's what that sounded like. The other fellow says, no, I think it sounded like a car hitting the wall. He said, I'm not so sure about that. It didn't sound like beer barrels rolling into it. It sounded like sort of a different kind of sound to me. So they've got different ideas. And maybe the mist clears a bit before the next train comes and they see what happened. So they have enough evidence to make a judgment. Maybe it doesn't, or maybe you know, somebody walks past and says, oh, there's a car accident down there. So they have evidence to reach this judgment. Of course, a lot of things in life that one time we took time to learn about have now become habitual. So it's not like we're always walking around and saying, ah, now, like Sherlock Holmes, did he go there and get the coffee there? This can happen very quickly in our minds, or we can reach snap judgments because things have become habitual. So at one time it took me time to learn to tie my shoelaces when I was a little boy. It now takes me time to tie them up again, not because I haven't got the skill. Now the skill is second nature. We say, I know how to do it now. It didn't take a long time. So we can reach a quick judgment about certain things become its second nature. It takes me time to get there down there now, to get down over my stomach and sort of bend over, but that's the different thing. But we can clearly see that there is a level here, because one thing depends on the other. We can't just walk into a room and say, well, it's true. And somebody says, well, what's true? Well, just it's true. What do you mean by it? Well, it's just true. It's true. It must be something about something I've understood. I make a judgment about something. So this level has to come before that level in that sense. But also, of course, we are partly higher animals, so we share the knowledge that higher animals also have. So as well as this distinctively human knowledge, which is about our being as souls, as spirits, as reasoning beings. So we share the same, we also share the knowledge that higher animals have. So, you know, I'm walking my grand dog, Minley. Now I used to have our own dog, now my married son's dog comes and visits us. So I walk around a little lane there in Devon, and a car comes around the corner, and we both dodge out of the way. That's the same kind of reaction that Minley the dog has as me. So we share that kind of knowledge, but she'll just go on and sniff the next bush, whereas I might start asking questions. Say, well, why the dickens did he do that here? He must, you know, he didn't need to go that fast around that bend. So we start to ask questions and think about search for truth in a way that dogs don't, and we have types of insights in the way that dogs don't. We understand mathematics.
And is it relevant to talk about beyond reasonable doubts and explain?
Yes, that's a good thing. Yes.
Well, we were talking about last night, and I thought, is this a relevant place?
Yes, beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, if you're a bit addicted, like my wife and I, to watching these kind of detective stories from America on YouTube, there's always a thing about beyond reasonable doubt. And St. John Henry Newman, I'm going to say, he has a wonderful book. His most philosophical book is The Grammar of Assent, where he talks a lot about this, and he uses legal examples too. So the thing about beyond reasonable doubt, so in a way, John Henry Newman and Thomas Aquinas, they'll talk about degrees of certainty, and they'll talk about degrees of probability. If you're saying something's highly probable, or it's certain with some degree of certainty, then it would be unreasonable to doubt this. It would be unreasonable to doubt this. And I mean, that's when we get into things like conspiracy theories, talking about somebody, might outside now, I don't know if there's a fun fair being set up outside now. I walk up to Stone House and I'll find the fields full of fun fair. They're all working silently. I mean, I can come up with something which is literally a silly hypothesis. It's not impossible that it's true. It's not impossible that a load of trucks have turned up since I went to Mass and they've set up a big fun fair. Somebody told me, I can't hear any noise. Oh, but they're creeping around like mice. So you keep on telling me more and more implausible things about this theory. You can't rule it out entirely. Well, I know, but it becomes more and more and more implausible. It becomes less and less and less probable. So that's when we say something that's silly, like all these conspiracy theories, who say, well, I'm not saying it's utterly impossible, this hypothesis, but I'm saying it is actually got to the level of silliness, because you're having to invent so many additional explanations of why this and that and that, and that. Like, oh well, it's going to be an enormous amount of noise if somebody's setting up a big top out there and going, oh no, but supposedly they're getting all the animals out terribly. Oh, why are they doing that? So I can, you can make up a story that I can't say is impossible, but I say it's highly improbable. The evidence can be, it's not present, or, it's a thing in reason. Entia non sum multiplicanda praeter necessitatem. It's what we call Occam's razor, the thing that predates Occam in the Middle Ages. You don't make up entities beyond what's necessary. So if I have evidence that somebody, a murder was committed, and I'm in the police and we find evidence that this person has died and it looks like foul play, I've got evidence for that, and there's a murder, I don't rush to the, there's no reason to rush to the say, oh yes, and 20 people were involved in the killing. Well, no, I have evidence that, well, certainly one person is involved in killing this person, but I can't reasonably say, oh, 20 people are involved in it until I find reason for that. So we don't multiply things beyond reason. You can't suddenly rush to some further hypothesis without sufficient evidence. Yes, I've got evidence that one person did commit a murder here. Maybe it turns out later I get evidence that two people are involved, or maybe it turns out evidence that there was people involved and killed. But at the moment, I have no evidence to say, oh yeah, well, 20 people are involved. Well, how do you know? There's no evidence at all. All the evidence points to one person being a murderer, but we have no evidence to say there are more. So you can't multiply things without evidence, and that's something in reason and logic that goes against, we have to think of when we see all these conspiracy theories. Well, yes, somebody says, well, it might, could be that aliens are running my car. Well, it's not impossible. Well, it's not impossible, but there are lots of things that are not impossible that are so unlikely, it's silly to think that they're true. So that's about evidence and probable judgments and what's improbable. So we looked at that cognitional structure of three stages or phases of process of coming to know. And as we saw there, we're not satisfied with mere concepts, ideas, whether clever or interesting, You see that in the history of science. You know, say, oh, well, this is just a great idea. But is it true? You know, X is the scientist's theory. It's lovely. It all fits together beautifully. You know, yeah, that's very good. That's a start. But is it true of reality? So then we need the evidence. We need to ask that further question. Ansett question, as Thomas is, and say, what's the evidence that your theory is true of reality? So that's what we're after as human beings. We're called to that truth. We see that in science, in scholarship, historians, archaeologists, whatever area of human inquiry. People are after being intelligent and reasonable in order to get to the truth, objective truth, being beyond that person. As human beings, we want to know being. We want to know whether our ideas truly correspond with reality. According to St. Thomas, veritas est adequatio rei et intellectus. Truth is the agreement of thing and intellect. It's an agreement between what we're thinking and being, reality. Truth is known in judgment, in which the intellect reflects and knows the similitude of its ideas with reality. Here's a few quotes and lines from St. Thomas. In a true, correct judgment, then, there is known the correspondence between my idea, concept, theory, and being, reality, the way things actually are. To deny this is actually to use it. This is a part of an important way of arguing in philosophy, that actually certain views are self-contradictory, or show that they're false even when we assert them. And that's very important. The ancient Greeks knew that, and you can use that kind of argument quite a bit. In fact, when we looked at cognitional structure, it's not just a theory, because actually to deny cognitional structure is to be engaged in using it. So if I argue against it, I have to see the words or hear somebody talk or something, communicate the theory to me. I've got to understand, have some ideas and concepts of what you're saying in this cognitional structure, and then I have to judge whether cognitional structure is true or false. So I have to use it in order to deny it. It's like I'm arguing that I don't argue, or I make I never make judgments. I just made one. You know, so as St. Thomas says, or recognizes, the man who claims there is no truth, and he's claiming that is true, contradicts himself. He's claiming that he knows it's true, that there is no truth, that he cannot know truth. And that's a very important thing to notice in philosophy, that denying truth, we can't escape it. We come back to it. And you can apply that to all these kind of post-Kantian, post-modernist things. They are self-destructive. They explode when applied to themselves. That's what he said. My old doctoral teacher, Hugo Mabel, once said, he's giving a talk about this kind of thing, that just sometimes philosophers say that, oh, you're sawing off the branch in which you're sitting. In other words, you're making a self-refuting statement like that. You're arguing that don't argue, or you're making a judgment that you don't judge. It's self-refuting, self-destructive. And so you're sawing off the branch in which you're sitting, that's the kind of thing. And Hugo was using that phrase. So that's be sawing, these postmodernists are sawing off the branch they're sitting on. They're using intelligence and reason to deny that we can get to anything through intelligence and reason. And somebody in the group said, oh, well, you can saw off the branch in which you're sitting. So Hugo said, well, okay, well, a better example would be to say, of course he had a very fruity accent, so a better example would be to say, I want to be a mass murderer, and so I'll start by shooting myself.